The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back.
We are back. Second hour of the National Intel Report. I'm your host, John Stadtmiller, with you on the 6th day of December 2018. And boy. Now, we're, by the way, Senior Bush was also known just simply as W down here in Texas. Wow. Now, Ronald Reagan, for the sake of this story, Ronald Reagan wasn't the brightest guy. He was a grade B actor when he was in Hollywood. But shift him over to politics with his ability to act in front of a camera, and the guy looked like a damn star. It didn't make him smart. Okay? Not any smarter than his wife was. His wife was as dumb as a box of rocks. If you ever listened to her, ever read anything that she wrote, she was a person of average intelligence. But you know, when you get to that vaunted state of being president and first lady, that somehow you're imbued with, I don't know, halos around your head or something. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because, guess what? W was ex-CIA. You don't think for a moment that George could have picked up the phone, contacted one of his CIA buddies and say, you know, what's really going on here? Because the story that's always being floated is that these presidents just, they're kept out of the loop. You know, plausible deniability. They don't know. George knew. He knew exactly what was going on. All right, so don't give me this crap about W being a good guy. His New World Order 1,000 points are like crap. After 3 days of this, and they're still talking about it today. The guy's dead. Leave it go. We'd had enough of George Bush. We want him buried as well. So at any rate, in this story, the CIA would later claim that Vaughn was a close associate of the Sandinistas' interior minister, Tomas Borga. But Vaughn had long been suspected of having his own ties to the CIA. His cousin Barney worked for the Popular Bank and Trust Company, once owned by the Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza. The bank was also used by the CIA and Oliver North's operation to funnel money to the Contras. In addition, a telephone number Seal later claimed to be Vaughn's Managua home phone number turned out to be a line used by the U.S. intelligence assets from 1981 to 1986. The Sandinistas claimed that Vaughn had worked as an assistant manager of an import-export company in the capital after the revolution, but had left Nicaragua for Panama in 1983. Now, Seal said that he and Vaughn flew the next day to Copa Airlines in Managua, where Vaughn showed the pilot of the 3,000-foot Las Brezas airstrip northwest of Managua. Vaughn Seal said, after pointed out the location of the Sandinistas' anti-aircraft guns stationed throughout the capital. Seal spent the night at Vaughn's house and returned to Florida the next day, just in time for his long-delayed sentencing hearing in Fort Lauderdale on his Quaalude smuggling conviction. Seal was sentenced to 10 years, but because of his cooperation with a drug operation, the sentence was reduced to 6 months probation. Wow. Nice to have friends in high places. Doesn't pay off to have friends in low places. Federal Judge Norman Rottinger, a law and order conservative who had received letters on Seal's behalf from the DEA and the CIA, praised Seal for his work undermining the Sandinista regime. These problems behind him, Seal was cleared for his first DEA-sanctioned cocaine run. On May 28th, Seal and his longtime co-pilot, Emil Camp, took off from MENA's Intermountain Regional Airport in Seal's retooled Lockheed Lodestar, bound for Colombia. They arrived at a small airstrip on the mountainside outside of Medellin in a driving rainstorm that turned the dirt runway into a strip of mud. Seal nearly wrecked the plane landing when the jet slid off the runway and into a ditch. The plane suffered damage to its landing gear, and Seal was forced to run the return flight in a smaller plane owned by the Medellin cartel. This plane was the same Titan 404 that Seal and Bates had delivered to the Medellin a month earlier. According to Seal, senior cartel executives Carlos Lender himself was at the airstrip to meet his plane from astride a white Arabian stallion. Lender supervised a team of Indians who loaded the Titan with a ton of cocaine. Now, the smaller plane limited range, Seal claimed, forced him to stop in Nicaragua for refueling. He landed at Brazil's airport, where he and Camp were greeted by Frederico Vaughn. The plane was quickly refueled and took off for Miami. But almost immediately, Seal told his DEA handlers his plane was struck by anti-aircraft fire, and he was forced to crash land the plane at the Managua airport. One of Vaughn's associates arrived in a military-style truck, took the cocaine away for safekeeping. Seal and Camp were detained overnight by the Nicaraguan police, but once again, Seal said in his thoroughly bizarre narrative of this episode, Vaughn came to the rescue, arranging their release from jail and providing them with a new plane to fly back to Florida. Seal claimed that this plane belonged to Pablo Escobar. Vaughn assured Seal that it would be safeguarded and the cocaine until Seal would come back for it. Seal arrived back to Miami and told his astounding tale to Jura and Jacobson. Far from being a disaster, Seal told the DEA men, this created a great opportunity to move against the Sandinistas. Plans were swiftly made by the DEA and the CIA for a return flight to Nicaragua. The first order of business was to get Seal a new plane. On June 10th, Seal traded his Merlin 3B, recently acquired from Ochoa, for the C-123K military cargo plane owned by the CIA contractor. Before it could be flown, however, the C-123 needed structural repairs and engine work. DEA agent Jacobson arranged for the Pentagon to have the plane shipped to the Rickenbacker Air Force Base outside of Columbus, Ohio, where Air Force mechanics performed $40,000 worth of free work on Seal's plane. After the repairs were completed, the cargo plane was flown to Homestead Air Force Base outside of Miami, where the CIA technicians installed two hidden cameras, one in the plane's nose cone and the other in the rear cargo hold. The cameras were rigged so that Seal could use a remote control button hidden in his pocket to snap photos at will. Now, on the morning of June 25th, Seal, Camp, and their mechanic, Peter Everson, landed the C-123K at Los Brazils airstrip. Although the CIA and President Reagan would refer to Los Brazils as a military airbase, it was in fact a civilian runway used primarily by crop dusters and other agricultural aircraft. Seal claimed that the plane was met by Frederico Vaughn, Pablo Escobar, Gonzalez Rodriguez, Gacha, and some Nicaraguan soldiers who helped carry more than 1,200 pounds of cocaine stuffed in duffel bags from the hangar to the rear of the plane. Seal clicked off a set of grainy and indistinct photos of the drug transfer. The plane itself took off about an hour later after taking on about 2,000 gallons of fuel. The next morning, Seal landed his C-123K, nicknamed the Fat Lady, at Homestead Air Force Base, where the DEA took control of the cocaine and the CIA agents rushed Seal's roll of film off to be developed in the agency's photo labs. Now, shortly after Seal returned to Florida, Ron Chafee, the head of the DEA's cocaine desk in Washington, D.C., received a call from his boss, David Westrate. Assistant Administrator of the DEA, Westrate instructed Caffrey to bring members of the National Security Council and the CIA on Seal's mission. The next day, Caffrey met with Oliver North and CIA agent Dewey Claridge. at the old executive office building adjacent to the White House. He showed North and Claridge blow-ups of SEAL's photos and identified pictures of SEAL's camp, Vaughn, and Escobar. But Caffrey was surprised to discover that both North and Claridge were already well acquainted with the photos. Caffrey recalled being somewhat unaware of Vaughn's background, but noticed that Claridge seemed to be packing a dossier on the man. The CIA representative told me that he, being Vaughn, was an associate of the government officer of the Nicaraguan government, which was news to me, Caffrey told a congressional committee looking into the SEAL affair. Now, the discussion between North, Claridge, and the DEA man rapidly turned into a planning of a new sting involving SEAL. They decided that SEAL should be sent back to Nicaragua with $1.5 million in DEA cash, along with assorted toys for Escobar and Vaughn, which are rumored to be brand new Harley Davidsons, to arrange a new drug deal. Now, at this point, Oliver North suggested that perhaps SEAL could arrange a deal outside of Nicaragua so that Vaughn and Escobar could be arrested and the $1.5 million turned over to the Contras. Now, Caffrey told the North and the U.S. Attorney's Office would never countenance such a scheme. Then North suggested that perhaps it's time for the DEA to go public with SEAL's photos. North told Caffrey, there is an important vote coming up on the appropriations bill to fund the Contras, and that information on the Sandinista drug dealing could swing the vote in the administration's favor. Again, Caffrey shot down North's idea. He told North that any release of information on the Nicaraguan flight would jeopardize their investigation of the Medellin cartel and place SEAL's life at risk. But the information was already beginning to leak out as part of the Reagan administration's propaganda campaign to demonize the Sandinistas. On June 27th, General Paul Gorman, head of the Pentagon's Southern Command, made an anti-Sandinista speech at a meeting hosted by the American Chamber of Commerce in El Salvador. Gore claimed to have proof that the Sandinista leadership was involved in drug smuggling. Now, this exposure, however, didn't stop the DEA from sending SEAL back to Nicaragua for another cocaine buy on July 7th. The deal was apparently aborted at the last minute when SEAL said he was warned that the Sandinistas had learned about the mission. By now, the National Security Council and the CIA were leaking reports of SEAL's Nicaraguan exploits to their friends in the Washington Press Corps. He's being burned here, folks. The Washington Times, in a July 17, 1984, front-page story of Edmund Jacoby, was the first to report on evidence of Sandinista drug trafficking. But Dear Ollie North, his diaries reveal that other reporters were also hot for the story. One of the first to lunge on it at the bait was Doyle McManus, the Los Angeles Times writer who savaged Gary Webb. Remember him? In North's July 17th entry, he wrote, McManus, LA Times says, NSC resource claims White House has pictures of Borga loading cocaine in Nicaragua. McManus's sources was dead wrong, of course, but Borga had been nowhere near the Barry SEAL plane. Within weeks, all the major, and here's where the propaganda that you'll recognize how they work. Within weeks, folks, all the major national papers and news magazines were running stories quoting high-level sources in the U.S. government who claimed that they had hard evidence that the Sandinista leadership was actively participating in the drug trade. The two names most often cited in the stories was Borga and Defense Minister Humberto Ortega, brother President of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega. I bet you were waiting for that name to pop up. On September 7th, with the Contra aid vote fast approaching, Senator Paula Hawkins, a right-wing Republican from Florida, convened a press conference in Washington at which she attacked the Sandinistas as a brutal regime financed by the drug trade. Hawkins unveiled to the press four obscure photos taken on SEAL's June 25th mission. She also displayed a high-altitude photo of Los Brazil's military airbase taken by an American U-2 spy plane. The photos weren't released to the press, but the press conference put the story on the front page once again. That's because it wasn't a military airbase, folks. It was for crop dusters. But by now, Barry SEAL's cover as a secret drug agent was completely blown, And he went back to what he did best, running drugs and guns. Now, fortunately for Seale, Congress was not persuaded to renew the Contra funding in the fall of 84, and instead enacted the Boland Amendment prohibiting any direct military aid. This meant Seale still had a job shuttling lethal contraband from North's network from MENA to El Salvador. Honduras and Nicaragua. An Arkansas police officer investigating Seale's operation in August of 1985 wrote in his report, "Every time Barry Seale flies a load of dope for the U.S. government, he flies for himself." In late December of 84, Seale was caught flying a load of marijuana into Louisiana. He was released the next day after he posted $250,000 cash bond. Seale made a call to his friends in the DEA, and on January 7th, he was interviewed by Special Agent Dale Hahn of the FBI. According to Hahn's notes, Seale offered to testify against low-level members of the Medellin cartel in exchange for a guilty plea and a light sentence on the marijuana trafficking charge. Over the next year, Seale testified in three major drug cases, helping the feds secure convictions. Seale was eventually sentenced to a six-month term in a halfway house in Baton Rouge. Shortly after Seale's arrest in Louisiana, his old friend and co-pilot, Emil Camp, died when his Seneca plane, equipped with the state-of-the-art navigational equipment, slammed into a mountain near MENA. Many of the Camp's associates believe that his plane had been sabotaged and point out that he was one of the few to witness many of Seale's activity for the CIA and the DEA. Now, in the summer of 1985, Seale decided to sell his C-123K cargo plane for $250,000. The buyer was the same CIA contractor, Harold Doan, from whom Seale had acquired the plane a year earlier. The plane later ended up in the service of Oliver North's Contra resupply program and entered aviation history on October 3, 1986, when it was shot down over Nicaraguan airspace, and its cargo kicker, Eugene Hassenfuss, was taken into custody by the Sandinistas and paraded before the world as living proof of the Reagan administration's war against their country. Now, although supposedly a witness protection program, Seale said he considered himself a clay pigeon. He was eventually tracked down by a team of assassins working for Jorge Ochoa and Pablo Escobar. Now, this is one point where I'll just kind of say that, you know what? I think that's a load of hunter. Yeah, did he piss Pablo Escobar off and Ochoa? Yeah, he certainly did. But who had more to gain and who had easier access to Barry Seale down in New Orleans? I guess it would be one of the spooks and kooks. Folks, if you walk around Baton Rouge, Louisiana, it's loaded with spooks and kooks. They're everywhere. And they were there in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s as well. I don't know if they're still there. Don't know. Don't really care. So, he knew he was a clay pigeon. He was eventually tracked down by a team of assassins, let's just say the Willie Wetwork team from the CIA, but they're saying it was Pablo's boys. Seale's body was riddled with hundreds of bullets as he sat in his white Cadillac outside a Salvation Army center in Baton Rouge. After Seale's death, IRS agents examined his bank records. They determined his estate owed more than $86 million in back taxes, but ended up forgiving much of that debt, citing Seale's CIA and DEA employment. By the mid-80s, Arkansas was an important staging post in the Contra War against Nicaragua being run from Washington. One scheme for maintaining a cover-up for Oliver North's network was, it appears, played out in Governor Manchin in Little Rock, Arkansas, occupied by a young Billy Clinton. Among the occupants of that same mansion was Buddy Young, the man in charge of Clinton's security, according to court documents filed by Terry Reed, former CIA asset. Interviewed Terry before. Involved in North's Contra's resupply effort, Young was a pivotal figure in a case designed to land Reed in prison not long after Reed had walked out of an arms for drugs operation in Guadalajara, Mexico, where he had been working with CIA man Felix Rodriguez. Coming to the end of this history lesson, folks, I thought after all of these years and all of the BS that's been spread, that you'd get some semblance of the truth of these vaunted presidential men sitting in our White House.
The First Amendment in the Bill of Rights limits the government's power by ensuring the freedom of speech and preserving the rights of the people. Every day that passes, our rights gradually slip away. It's time to take a stand and let the government know we're tired of losing our rights. LibertyStickers.com will allow you to express your rights and allow millions of people to see you stand up for what you believe in. LibertyStickers.com carries the largest selection of bumper stickers online, ranging from political to humorous, and is your number one source for Ron Paul for President stickers. As always, you can find your favorite stickers that protest the war and the president. Don't see what you're looking for? Liberty Stickers will custom make stickers that will let you get your message across for all Americans to see. Go to LibertyStickers.com and see pre-made stickers that will get everyone talking. That's LibertyStickers.com or call 877-873-9626. Liberty Stickers, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Attention RBN listeners, Dr. Ignatius Piazza, founder of Frontsight Firearms Training, and Fate have come together to allow RBN to run another fundraiser till the end of the year. We didn't really expect this opportunity, but thankfully, it's here and running as you hear this. We've set a goal of 500 donations by the end of the year, which averages around 6 per day, 7 days a week. When you realize all the folks listening to RBN all hours of the day and night, we think our goal is realistic and extremely critical to keep RBN on the air. If everybody listening will seriously assess their ability with firearms and then take advantage of this opportunity, we feel our goal is very conservative. Please take the time to look over FrontSight's website to get an idea of an amazing facility and the world-class training that's going on there. If this interests you, you likely will have like-minded friends that would like to know. Tell them. If for some reason some listeners are not personally interested, consider sons and daughters, close friends, nieces or nephews, top valued employees, inform club members, share the opportunity with police and fire departments. It's not too early to plan Christmas presents for special people. This fundraiser has come at an extremely critical time for RBN because the dire need for equipment upgrades. We're running on the spare tire currently with no money to fix a flat, and the fuel gauge is bouncing on E. This is one of the most valuable ways you can help RBN financially because you get Commander lifetime membership value that is 50 times your donation and can be passed on forever. How many times during life do you get to leave a legacy? See more details and contact info on our webpage, republicbroadcasting.org, and thank you. Crickets and Wolves. What bumper music is this? Okay. All right, at least it isn't a foreigner saying I want to stick around till I can't see straight. Only you would pick that bumper for me. Baby Driver? Okay, you do realize, of course, they can only hear one side of this conversation. Okay, and I'm... Right. Okay. You done now? Okay. Arkansas's role in the Contra War and in the Arms for Drugs Supply Network goes back to the early 80s and the airport at Mena. Federal investigation aided by the Arkansas State Police established that Barry Seal had his planes refitted at Mena for drug drops, trained pilots there, and laundered his profits partly through financial institutions in Arkansas. Yeah, he basically bought a town, at any rate. Seal at this time was in close contact with North, who acknowledged the relationship in his notebooks and his memoirs. Among those recruited by North was the man subsequently asserted in court papers, Terry Reed, formerly the Air America in Thailand, Reed says he was working for North in 1983. North put Reed in touch with Seal, and by 84, Reed had established a base at the hamlet at Nella, 10 miles north of Mena, in the Quachita National Forest. Hope I didn't butcher that too badly. There, Nicaraguan Contras and other recruits from Latin America were trained in resupply missions, night landings, precision airdrops, and similar maneuvers. Reed, familiar with the commercial affairs of Mena, asserts that large sums of drug money were being laundered through leading Arkansas bond brokers, an allegation also being considered by a federal investigator, just as his researchers were abruptly, his research abruptly terminated. One of Reed's contacts in North's network was William Cooper, another Air America veteran then working for Southern Air Transport. Cooper was at the controls of the C-123K, once owned by Barry Seal, was shot down by the Sandinistas' soldiers in October of 1986. That plane had been serviced at Mena. Cooper died in a crash. His crewman, Eugene Hassenfuss, survived. Back in 1885, Cooper had suggested to Reed that he go to Mexico, set up an operation expanding the supply network. Reed agreed, traveled to Veracruz for a discussion with Felix Rodriguez. In July of 86, they set up a front company, Machinery International, in Guadalajara. 3 months later, Cooper was dead, and Hassenfuss was being paraded by the Sandinistas before the Managua Press Corps. Reed says the Machinery International's business, transshipping items in support of our foreign politics, was put on hold until January of 87. This at the time when the Iran-Contra cover-up was pressing forward in Washington. 7 months later, Reed says he became aware that the drugs were part of the shuttle passing through the Machinery International's premises in Guadalajara, and that he himself was likely a candidate for the fall guy if things came unglued. Reed says he confronted Rodriguez and told him he was quitting. By early September 1987, he had returned to the United States. A month later, Governor Clinton's security chief, Buddy Young, was activating from the governor's mansion a sequence of events seemingly designed to land the potentially troublesome Reed in prison. The instrument in hand was a plane owned by Reed, and on March 24th of 83, Reed's plane had been stolen from a repair shop in Joplin, Missouri. Prior to this, Reed says Oliver North had asked him to contribute the same plane to Project Democracy, a scheme by which individuals would allow their fully insured planes and boats to disappear for the sake of counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua. You're kind of getting the hint here that old Ollie was up to his eyeballs. Remember that little speech that he gave in front of what we were allowed to see in front of Congress? What was this guy's reward? Kept his pension, got a radio show. Everything is right with the world. The son of a bitch should have went to prison for a very long time. But, you know, folks, in this world, one of these little turds gets squeezed and gosh knows what's going to come out. Maybe the names of other people that were involved with you. So sometimes it's just better to pat him on the head and say, good job, boy, and here's your bone. On October 8, 1987, Tommy Baker, former Arkansas State Police officer and longtime friend of Buddy Young, says he happened to be passing Reed's hangar when a powerful gust of wind blew the door open, revealing a plane. Baker said he thought the plane looked suspicious, so he called his pal, Young, at the governor's mansion. Young later claimed in testimony that he contacted the National Crime Information Center to check and see if the plane's registration number came back of a list of stolen planes, found no record of this, and then instructed Baker to check if the plane's markings had been changed, a common practice of plane thieves, also a routine practice at Mena and North's Project Democracy, by the way. Baker established that they had been altered, and by October 21, the two claim they turned the case over to the FBI. Well, here comes the FBI. You know, those trusted guys in that agency. Not. We'll take the break. We'll be back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855, the number 2, keep it today.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
This is too good to be true, except this time it is real. 100%. No joke. How about a $25,000 membership to Front Sight Firearms Training Facility as a thank you bonus for a one-time donation to RBN of only $400? It is a Commander Lifetime membership with no yearly fees or dues. The training is free for the rest of your life with over 50 different classes. Then leave it to your designated beneficiary. You provide the approved firearm, holster, ammo, eye, and ear protection. Many features and bonuses are included, more than you would ever expect or believe. This is the ultimate graduation present, wedding gift, etc., etc. See the details. Go to RBN's webpage and frontsight.com to make it happen. You will hear this offer only on this radio network. Help keep RBN alive. Tell five. So, after all this insurance scam stuff is going down, Reed accused Young and Baker of preparing and preventing false evidence for the purpose of furthering a false prosecution. Now, this much is clear. In efforts to discredit someone familiar with the MENA operation, Buddy Young made his calls from Bill Clinton's mansion. Young and Baker have admitted to entering Reed's hangar three times without a warrant. They also admitted to tampering with the plane. When they finally did obtain a warrant, it was on the basis of misrepresentations. According to court documents, they subsequently made false statements to a federal grand jury as on a more than one occasion in hearings related to the United States versus the Reed family. Evidence that might have helped Reed's case was secreted in Young's office in Clinton's mansion. By the way, I got to stop and digress for a second. Old Billy Boy was getting all the cocaine he could snort. And he did. Even his brother said, "Oh, Billy, he's got a nose like a vacuum cleaner." "I did not have sex with that woman." Yeah. Jeez. And that's the whole Billy Clinton legacy. Oh, it was the Monica Lewinsky thing, wasn't it? It was about stains on a dress. God almighty. Oh. A federal judge involved in this case, Frank Thies, declared that Baker and Young had acted with reckless disregard for the truth. Reed was acquitted when the court determined that the government didn't have enough legitimate evidence to convict him. In other words, the lies weren't good enough, and the judge says, I can't make this fly. He'll win on appeal. 3 months before his assassination, Barry Seal described in sworn testimony to federal and state investigators a nexus of airstrips, front corporations, legitimate, quote-unquote, Arkansas companies, and banks participating in the shipment of drugs and laundering of drug profits. His interrogators, IRS agent Bill Duncan and Russell Welch of the Arkansas State Police, had hoped to get Seal to gradually detail a bigger picture and were frustrated in their efforts when Seal, then under a drug conviction in Louisiana, was returned to that state for sentencing. When he was killed, one important path toward uncovering the Contra resupply operation in Arkansas, well, folks, the case just went cold. And Billy went on to be president of the United States. Nevertheless, Duncan and Welsh were determined to continue their investigation, follow the trails leading from MENA into the rest of the state, where the money trail ultimately led. The investigators were never able to discover fully because their investigation was abruptly halted. One alleged money launderer, conspicuous in Arkansas's political financial world and profitability involved in state business, was, according to a source whose information had proved reliable in the past, in receipt of large sums of drug money from Seal, Duncan and Welsh eventually prepared a 3,000-page file on MENA documenting widespread money laundering and drug running. Duncan prepared 35 indictments for the U.S. attorney, but they were never acted upon. And in 1988, the Arkansas State Police began shredding its MENA files, including all documents linking Oliver North to Seal and Seal's associate, Terry Reed. Guess what else was ground up in that little exercise? Bill Clinton's involvement in this as well. Now, there's every indication that many of the illicit activities linking intelligence agencies to drug traffickers continued into the 1990s. An IRS report from the fall of 91, 3 years after Duncan left the agency, notes that the CIA has ongoing operations out of MENA, Arkansas Airport. One of the operations of the airport is laundering money. Well, guess who became president in 1992? That's right, Bill Clinton. There is every indication that many of the illicit activities linking intelligence agencies to drug traffickers continued into the 1990s. An IRS report from the fall of 91, like I said, pulled the stuff out, said MENA Arkansas Airport, this was the operation, this was the center of the drug laundering money. Duncan, a special agent in the IRS Criminal Division, was assigned to MENA, the investigation in 1983. And in 1989, he was called to testify before the House Judiciary Committee about the goings-on in MENA. Now, notice the time span here, 1983 to 1989. Let me see, that's 6 years. Given another year, and there's kind of a statute of limitations. Well, all that stuff. In case we forgot to kill somebody. You know, 7 years, only for murder and treason. Now, this committee had convened to probe the lack of criminal indictments and the possible hampering and the investigations by the CIA and Clinton's gubernatorial staff in Little Rock. Another agency under scrutiny was the U.S. Attorney's Office, which had been empowered to convene a grand jury and bring indictments in the affair, but it didn't do so. Duncan had learned of the alleged payoff to U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese by suspects in the MENA investigation. He was told by the IRS attorney to deny congressional investigators he had any knowledge of this allegation and to state that he had no opinion on the reluctance of the U.S. attorneys to convene a grand jury. He refused. Shortly thereafter, Duncan was transferred from his IRS job to a position on the Subcommittee on Crime of the House Judiciary Committee, where he continued to probe MENA. Later that year, Duncan was arrested at the Capitol building in Washington for possession of a concealed weapon. That being his service weapon, folks. As he tried to enter his office, the case went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, where it was held in limbo for more than a year, effectively preventing Duncan from pursuing what? The MENA, Arkansas case. He quit the House Judiciary Committee and went into position with the Arkansas Attorney General's office. Russell Welch also suffered a similarly rocky career. He had been a criminal investigator for the Arkansas State Police, worked closely with Duncan on the Mina case since 1983. When the federal government closed down its inquiry, Welsh's superiors in Arkansas also took him off the case. Welsh claims that the attempt was made on his life in 91 while he was meeting with Duncan in Little Rock. In 1992, spokeswoman Max Parker was asked why Clinton had never responded to the 1990 request of Deputy Prosecutor Charles Black for assistance in forwarding a state inquiry into the rather wide array of the illegal activities centering on the MENA airport. Black, whose jurisdiction includes MENA, suspected a federal cover-up of activities there. Parker claimed that Black was merely a subordinate in the prosecutor's office and that Clinton went straight to the top. She said Clinton told State Police Commander Tommy Goodwin that he would allow $25,000 to be released to the chief prosecutor in Black's district, Joe Hardigree. Hardigree, Parker said, rejected Clinton's offers of funds and pro-offered by Goodwin, presumably according to Parker, because $25,000 was insufficient for such a probe. But this claim contradicts what Hardigree said in 1992 letter to Mark Swaney of the Arkansas Committee, a group of citizens looking into the MENA affair. During my tenure as prosecuting attorney, I did not receive $20,000 or $25,000 in state funds or any part of this amount of money, nor did I hear anything concerning these state funds from Colonel Goodwin or anyone at Arkansas State Police or anyone in the governor's office. The only investigation that I'm aware of which has expended funds or resources has been the grand jury investigation of the federal court for the Western District of Arkansas. In October of 91, U.S. Congress appropriated another $25,000 upon the intervention of Arkansas Representative Bill Alexander. The money languished unused in the state police headquarters. Parker said it was just a matter of completing some paperwork and that Goodwin would straighten everything out. But Goodwin was less than forthcoming on the matter of the interview during the 1992 election season, where once the policeman had been enthusiastic about the resumption of an investigation, now he said wasn't sure there would be any value to it, adding that even if the MENA investigation was to proceed, the chief investigator Duncan, who was at that time sequestered from reporters and the inquiries by his superiors in the Attorney General's office, would not have subpoena power. Hardigree said that it looked as if the political pressure had been exerted on Goodwin. These are all good people, but they're too involved in politics, Hardigree said. I think the world of Tommy Goodwin, but someone's put the heat on him. Now, at a crucial stage in the Contra War, Governor Bill Clinton's personal creation, the Arkansas Development Finance Authority, made its first industrial development loan. The year was 1985, and the recipient of that loan was Park on Meter Inc., or POM, a parking meter manufacturer based in Russellville, Arkansas. Russellville, you remember that? The guns being made? Okay, just wanted to remind you. POM, it has been alleged by Michael Reconsudo, a computer expert serving a prison sentence on drug charges in Washington State, was under secret contract to make components of prototype chemical and biological weapons for use by the Contras, as well as special equipment for the C-130 transport planes. Such planes were at the time ferrying drugs and weapons in and out of Arkansas, MENA, which is just a few miles away in western Arkansas. Clinton's state was thus an important link to the Contra supply chain at the time when military aid to the Contras had been banned by Congress. About a mile north of the airport in Russellville on Highway 331 sits POM's headquarters and factory in a low building made of corrugated metal. POM began making parking meters in this site in 1976. Except for some superficial altercations, its premises are the same ones once owned and occupied by defense giant Rockwell International. Back when POM took over the site from Rockwell, its property covered a little more than 36 acres. But between 1976 and 92, a complicated series of real estate transactions, the county court documents, 15 mortgages or deeds concerning this property over the period, left POM itself owning only about 8 acres. The remainder of the property POM deeded to a partnership called MBVG. And in 1990, one of the partners of this new company, a man named Mac Van Horn, leased a portion of the property to the U.S. Army Reserve. A plot of land northwest of Palm's property housed the 354th Chemical Company of the 122nd Army Reserve Command. When Mark Swaney of the Arkansas Committee investigated the site, he saw two camouflage trucks and trailers mounted with what looked like generators for creating smoke screens, along with some military transport trucks and a number of industrial drums. Swaney talked to some of the soldiers there and told them that they were part of a smoke unit. A few days later, former IRS investigator Bill Duncan took a trip out to Russellville. Duncan saw the drums sitting next to the two corrugated metal sheds without windows or markings of any kind. Duncan also said what he described as a chemical tanker truck at Army Reserve Post. In short, here in a scruffy corner of Russellville was the kind of military industrial landscape, a setting appropriate to our tale. Southwest of Russellville was another kind of military industrial landscape, this one in the wooded valley that surrounds Mena. So far, we've described Mena as a center for covert operations involving Contra training and resupply missions, as well as drug smuggling and money laundering. Mena was also important as a base for aircraft maintenance and retrofitting. We come now to Michael Reconosudo, a former contract employee of the CIA who says he worked at Mena on and off between 1980 and 1989. Reconosudo was arrested on drug charges shortly after being named as a witness in the Inslaw's Corporation case against the U.S. government for the latter's alleged unauthorized use of Promise software, which Reconosudo wrote for Inslaw. Now, he claims he was set up. He's now in prison in Washington State. According to Reconosudo, Mena was part of a network of bases that evolved over time, rising and receding in importance with the changing needs of the U.S. covert operations. He says that at the time he was involved, Mena was crucial because of its central location relative to other bases, because of this retrofitting and maintenance facilities, and because of its role as the administrative center of the operations. Finally, he says Mena was the main drop-off point for narcotic shipments, the other bases serving as distribution points or nesting facilities for the aircraft, mainly a fleet of about 30 C-130 transport planes. Thus, Reconosudo, in his third person who stepped forward with details of the covert military narcotics operation at Mena, corroborating information already supplied by Barry Seal and Terry Reed, but unlike Seal, who was primarily a drug smuggler, and Reed, who supervised the training of pilots and participated in resupply operations, Reconosudo served in a technical and administrative capacity that gave him a broader picture of the whole operation. He came to Mena with a background in computer technology and programming, as well as intelligence experience, gaining from working with the Wackenhut Corporation, private security firm whose association with the intelligence world is well known. In Mena, Reconosudo supervised the transshipment of high-tech equipment, including infrared gun scopes and night vision goggles to the Contras, maintained the administrative computer network, and developed accounting software, to facilitate the electronic transfers of funds for the money laundering side of the operation. Reconosudo says that his knowledge, no drugs were ever unloaded at Mena Airport itself. Yeah. As with SEALs set up in Louisiana, planes flying low altitude would use drag chutes to drop containers of drugs in the surrounding countryside. Sometimes the dope would be dropped into clear cuts in the national forest up there. More often, it would be dropped onto farmland outside of Mena. The drugs would then be picked up by helicopter or truck, taken to a loading area from which they would be sent to distribution points via truck or two-engine planes. He described the constellation of support facilities for both the shipment of drugs and the manufacture of airplane parts. Independent sources for parts were especially necessary, both to ensure a ready supply of equipment that could not easily be traced if a plane crashed or it was captured. Reconosudo's account of these support facilities matched in many of its particulars the evidence gathered by state and federal investigators who were on the trail of the Mena operation in 1983 to 1988. But in the same way that his story augmented the picture drawn from Seal to Reed, so it extends the line of supporting actors beyond the environs of Mena, which brings us back to the headquarters of Palm. Palm, according to Reconosudo, It's not Mueller in the business of making parking meters. He says that beginning in 1981, the company also made ferry drop tanks, external fuel canisters, for use on C-130s. Drop tanks are essentially nothing more than aerodynamic metal containers, well within the production capabilities of the company, set up to make parking meters. These tanks attached to pylons in the wings of jettison when empty are necessary to long fuel range transport missions. While standard on the C-130 and other military aircraft, they're virtually unknown in civilian use. To this point, most of our discussion, MENA has centered on the conventional weapons delivery and more or less conventional training. But Reconsudo points out to others that even more sinister tactic that began to take shape in Arkansas. By 1983, he says it was clear to the U.S. intelligence that the Contras were able to inflict real damage on the Sandinista troops and needed a tactical advantage, either through the use of high-technology weaponry and equipment, such as infrared and night vision devices mentioned above, or through unconventional weaponry. To this end, Reconsudo says Palm was enlisted in a project with Stormont Labs of Woodland, California, and Wackenhut Corporation to develop chemical and biological weapons that could be deployed in guerrilla warfare. Palm was assigned the task of producing the munitions themselves. Now, recall the configurations on the ground in the corner of Russellville described, according to Reconsudo, the Army Chemical Unit had been an arrangement to provide Palm with chemical agents once the prototypes had become advanced enough for testing. And these prototypes were meant to be fairly simple devices, a handheld grenade or a mortar shell or a small bomb, all of which could have been produced with the machinery on hand at Palm. Stormont confirmed in 1992, in the early 80s, it was approached by Wackenhut in connection with the development of biological weapons, but denied that anything went beyond the talking stage. Wackenhut denied any involvement with Stormont, Palm, or Reconsudo when asked in 1992 about the allegations by Reconsudo that Palm built aircraft drop tanks and had been engaged to produce biochem munitions. Skeeter Ward, boss at Palm, said breezily to Bryce Hoffman of The Nation, "Hell no, what we make is re-entry nose cones for nuclear warheads on the MX missiles and nozzles for rocket engines." He also said, "We have a lot of contract with McDonnell Douglas to make aircraft parts, but I don't even know what this is all about." Skeeter Ward is the brother-in-law of Webster Hubble, Clinton's disgraced assistant attorney general. Wasn't it Webster Hubble that ended up with all the bullets and the body that was moved? Was that Webster? Or am I thinking the other guy? At any rate, I'll think of it in a second. There's so much to keep track of. These criminals are just as shifty as little cockroaches in the dark. Seth Ward Sr., the father of Hubble's wife, Susie, while an attorney at Rose Law Firm, Hubble had shepherded Palm's application to become the first company to receive an industrial development loan from the Arkansas Development Finance Authority. This loan for $2.75 million was rushed to completion in the closing hours of 1985. The Arkansas Development Finance Authority came into being in April of that year as part of the Clinton Sweeping Economic Development Initiative, what had previously been the Arkansas Housing Development Agency, which offered low-interest loans to develop single-family housing, was now revamped into a kind of full-service financial institution charged with attracting capital into the state for the purposes of industrial development, job creation, agriculture, and even aquacultural financing. It advertised itself as an agency especially helpful to small companies who have traditionally been excluded from the bond market by high insurance costs and servicing fees, but which under the umbrella of the ADFA, bond issues, would be able to trim such cost. Now, the crux of the ADFA's mission was to offer companies long-term loans financed through the sale of tax-exempted bonds. Companies in need of capital would come to the ADFA, which in turn arranged for the insurance of a bond from a private bondholder, which then was offered for sale. When the bonds were sold, the ADFA delivered the indenture and the record of the bond owners to a bank, which became the trustee of the deal. Now, ADFA thus served as a kind of middleman in a deal between the trustee and the companies. The trustee was responsible for collecting the payments on the loan and the interest, and was also responsible for paying out dividends and ultimately the principal to the bondholders. Now, these trustees had a huge latitude in deciding where to invest these funds. According to the ADFA's standard contract, the trustee was limited only by the stipulation that wherever the money was invested, it had to be guaranteed by the U.S. government in some way. However, the stipulation was not always honored. There were records of deals which a trustee invested in Fuji's Bank Grand Cayman Islands branch. A favorite depository of drug money down there. Now, many of these beneficiaries of the ADFA bore the same aroma of Clinton's inner circle. Among underwriters of the agency bond issue, Stevens Inc. featured prominently. The company's chairman, Jackson Stevens, and his son, Warren, helped the Clintons raise more than $100,000 for his 1992 campaign. In January of that year, the bank Stevens has a controlling interest in Worthern National extended Clinton a $2 million line of credit. The name of Wharton Bank, represented by Hillary Rodham Clinton's Rose Law Firm, on several occasions appeared among institutions that have from time to time had liens on Palm. Another familiar name in the bond issuers were a now-defunct Lassiter & Company, Dan Lassiter, who headed the company, is a longtime friend of Clinton and his brother, Roger. Both Roger Clinton and Lassiter were convicted on cocaine charges. The ADFA was the center of financial dealings in which large amounts of money could be moved around easily, and it would seem discreetly, because the ADFA was not subject to legislative oversight, being solely within the purview of the governor's office, and because of loose strictures upon the trustee bank. It also opened the gate for questionable, possibly illicit financial dealings. As IRS man Bill Duncan explained, theoretically, bonds could be issued to provide a loan to a company involved in laundering drug profits. That loan represented clean money. The loan would in turn be paid back with drug profits. Slowly over time and in small increments, in this way, drug money could be successfully filtered into legitimate financial systems if the company in question did nothing more than a loan and then redeposit it in its bank account. Then the company had lost nothing, but it had gained what? Clean money. Thus, in effect, the ADFA could serve as a washing machine. Dirty money could be cleaned simply by passing through its system. Duncan suggested that it would also be possible for the ADFA clients never to repay a loan and for the money to simply be circulated through the trustee's investment end of the arrangement. In the case of Palm, records concerning the $2.75 million loan were curiously incomplete. One ADFA document stated that 24 jobs had been created, another cited total wages paid of $2.56 million. No repayment record of Palm were available in 92 when the operations were under scrutiny. Through the ADFA, officials said that Palm had paid off the loan in 91, 2 years ahead of schedule. Now, I am flat out of time here, folks, and I've got about five paragraphs to go. I wanted to get this whole thing in here. I wanted to tell you simply this, that this government has been involved in many duplicitous things. Now, who we just buried Wednesday, yesterday, well, there was official burial. You know, the kind, gentler, thousand points of light guy. You know, the guy that he was very nice and very humble and everybody respected. Remember, he was vice president under Reagan when all this crap was going down. Who was in the governor's office in Arkansas right under Billy's big nose, coke-sniffing nose? That's right. And all these criminals are still walking free. Do you understand now why the Clinton Foundation and all of its spiderling webs going out will never be investigated? Because it's going to pull down still too many now living real high-level criminals, folks. You're not going to see anything, in my estimation, you're not going to see anything happen with this Clinton Foundation thing. They're just going to wear the public out with it, and the new crime enterprise will move in with new bosses to cover new asses. There's my tribute to you, W. And Billy, I hope to hell they lock you in a cage, you and that scraggly thing you call a wife, in a cage for a public exhibition until the day you die. Thank you for being here, folks. We'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.